Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for joining in on the Sydney Institute's virtual meetings at a time of pandemic. And as I've said before, it's unfortunate we can't have people in the room with us, but it is fortunate we can engage our people who live out of Sydney, who are our supporters and followers, and they can join in on these discussions. So there's a positive and a negative. But tonight we're fortunate to have two prominent Australian commentators. They're well known. I'll introduce them briefly. Milton Cockburn, a former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, who worked on Neville Rand's staff, the Premier of New South Wales staff at the time of the Luna Park fire tragedy, and Troy Bramston, a senior writer at the Australian, who edited the book The Rand Era, which was published around a decade or so ago. Now, we're going to start very briefly with Milton just setting us the background, a brief comment on the background so we all know what we're talking about. Then we go to Troy. Then we go back to Milton. After about half an hour, we go to questions and discussion and finish no later than the top of the hour on the topic, the ABC's Luna Park fire conspiracy beat-up. Milton, off you go.
Thanks very much, Jared. And thanks to the Sydney Institute for providing this forum tonight. I'd also just like to start by saying and paying tribute to my co-speaker tonight, Troy Bramston, in drawing attention to the program's many flaws in The Australian. Troy has been criticised inside the ABC as acting as just a cat's paw for us Rand clackers, as Richard Ackerman has called us, which is just a small group of people who regard our time on the staff of Neville Rand as being one of the privileges of our working life. We'd actually decided that we weren't going to say anything after the program, noting that, in fact, the program had pretty well been ignored by the rest of the mainstream media. And we thought if we said something, it would just simply give oxygen to the program. We thought we'd thoroughly dissect the program and then decide later how we would publicise our findings. And it was a few weeks later when Troy came back from book leave and off his own bat began to examine the program. And it was only then that we decided to say something public. But anyway, as Jared said, I just want to summarise for those who did not see the program or who saw it 4 months ago, let me just summarise the findings. The program claimed that the ghost train fire at Luna Park in June 1979 was deliberately lit by a group of bikies, that the bikies were acting on the instructions of Sydney crime boss Abe Saffron, that Saffron had ordered the fire because he wanted to gain control of the harbourside site for commercial development, and that the cause of the fire was covered up by corrupt police and politicians, and that Saffron had eventually gained the lease for Luna Park through a Saffron-linked corporate vehicle. The program also made three specific allegations against Rand. First, that Rand, at the request of High Court Judge Lionel Murphy and Sydney solicitor Morgan Ryan, had, and I quote here the words of the presenter, quote, intervened to make sure that the lease swung over to Abe Saffron, end quote. Second, the program alleged that Rand did so because he was in cahoots, had a friendly relationship with Saffron. And third, the program alleged that Rand had helped cover up Saffron's involvement in arson and murder. So that's just a brief summary of the allegations. I'll come back and address those allegations after Troy has given his talk.
Thank you, Milton. So it's over to you, Troy.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and also to Anne. I really do appreciate you inviting me back to the Sydney Institute, and I want to also pay tribute to Milton Cockburn, who I've known for many years, and it's good to be sharing a platform with him tonight. In April 2021, I watched the ABC's three-part documentary on the Luna Park ghost train fire, which tragically claimed the lives of six children and one adult. It was a tragedy, and I have, from the get-go, supported calls for a fresh investigation into the fire, given the allegations that have been raised. I was aware of the controversy over the fire and the many conspiracy theories over the years, but I did come to the documentary with an open mind. It was a big production for the ABC, one of the few documentaries they've made in-house in recent years. Indeed, it was revealed during Senate estimates that it cost almost $2 million to make. And the documentary team consisted of two reporters, Caro Meldrum-Hanna and Patrick Begley, and also a producer and an executive producer who worked on it over a 15-month period. So expectations were quite high for this documentary. And I did not actually plan to write anything about it, but as I watched it, I became increasingly skeptical about many of the claims that were being made. So tonight I want to first discuss the theory about how the fire started and who was responsible, and then I'll discuss the claims of political conspiracy which Milton has outlined. I want to note that television is a very powerful medium, and what people see and hear can strongly influence their opinion. It can leave a lasting impression that is often very hard to shake. And this is, I think, especially the case when most people would not be particularly familiar with the details of what happened in 1979 at Luna Park, certain archival documents that are available, and also the background and reliability of a number of the interviewees. So as Milton said, the documentary claims the fire was lit by a gang of bikies using kerosene as an agent on behalf of criminal underworld figure Abe Saffron. Now, I've examined the weakness of these claims of arson and conspiracy first in the Weekend Australian on April 24 this year. I think it's worth noting that the ABC did not actually find one person who saw the fire being lit. Instead, they produced multiple witnesses who saw bikies at Luna Park that evening. But the ABC didn't produce any witness either who said that they had a direct conversation with Saffron, confessing that he was behind the fire. The documentary repeats that police thought the fire was caused by an electrical fault, and a lot of time is spent discussing and questioning this. But the documentary did not pay much attention to what the coronial inquiry, headed by respected coroner Kevin Anderson, actually investigated and examined. The coroner said the most probable cause of the fire was a tossed cigarette or match, which ignited the ramshackle ride, which was a known fire risk. The coroner considered sparks from the tracks igniting the flammable paint on the walls or a slow-starting electrical fault. This would be entirely consistent with those who were interviewed in the documentary, who saw flames in an imitation fireplace inside the ride and also on the walls. Now, Tony Jacob was the ghost ride attendant that night. He clipped the tickets for every person who rode the ghost train. He was interviewed for the documentary, and he was given an award for bravery for trying to rescue those who had been trapped inside the ride on the evening as it became an inferno. But here's something the ABC did not include in their documentary. Tony Jacob did not see any bikies that night, and he did not smell any kerosene. Now, I had a text exchange with Jacob after he was interviewed by Serena Andaloro on 7 News in May this year. Nobody was in a better position to judge whether there were bikies who took the ghost train that night and whether kerosene was used as a fire agent. So his testimony, I think, torpedoes the ABC's arson claims. He told the ABC this, but they did not use it in the documentary. And the thing is, if there's no arson, then there simply cannot be a criminal conspiracy. I think the fire was likely a very tragic accident, as the coroner suggested. Now, a theme of the documentary is that the police investigation was flawed and there are witnesses who claim to have been pressured to change their testimony. It is known, of course, that elements of the police force in this era were corrupt, and the initial investigation into the fire was flawed and I think there was a rush to judgment. But these are hardly revelations. But in the final episode of the documentary, Meldrum Hanna tells the victims' families that there was a cover-up, and moreover, it went all the way to the top. Neville Wran was the New South Wales Premier at the time of the fire, and if anyone was the top, then it was Wran. And this overall conclusion came after Wran's name was dragged through the mud in the documentary. The documentary claims that Wran had Friday night drinks with Abe Saffron and that they were really pally. This accusation is made by Saffron's employee, Rosemary Opitz. Her credibility, I think, is risible. And the Premier, the idea of the Premier and a gangster having Friday night drinks, I think it's beyond stupid. And no other person has been produced by the ABC to support this claim. But it gets even more ludicrous. Former policeman Paul Egg claims in the documentary that illegal police wiretaps, the so-called age tapes, revealed that after the fire, Wran conspired with High Court Judge Lionel Murphy to ensure that the Luna Park lease went to a company that disguised Saffron's interest. Meldrum Hanna says this allegation was confirmed. It was an allegation made by Egg decades ago, but the truth of it is that it has never been confirmed at all. This, I think, was a sleight of hand by Meldrum Hanna, which misled the audience. Egg's claim was considered by the Stuart Royal Commission into the age tapes and could not be substantiated. It was also examined by the Parliamentary Commission of Inquiry into Justice Murphy, which also said that it was an unproven claim. Now, Egg did not hear this claim about Wran on the tapes. He only read it in a transcript. But the transcript, let alone the tape, has never been found. And Stuart found that some of the transcripts and the summaries to be unreliable, and he doubted the objectivity of some of the police who compiled them. The ABC did not produce any recordings or transcripts to verify Egg's claim about Wran, and no other policeman corroborated this specific allegation about Wran in the documentary. But the ABC ran with this discredited claim made by Egg so that it could link Wran to the fire and then to Abe Saffron. I don't think Egg should ever have been interviewed for the documentary. And during Senate estimates in May this year, the ABC's managing director, David Anderson, and editorial director, Craig McMurtry, were asked if the ABC had in fact, and I quote, verified the content of the tapes which formed the basis of the allegation against Wran. Now, in a written reply, the ABC did not confirm it had sourced any recordings or any transcripts implicating Wran. Yet Anderson and McMurtry defended the documentary because they said it made only allegations and it did not really matter if these were right or wrong or if they were proven facts. Further, they claim this was done in the true crime genre, suggesting somehow that it was more entertainment than journalism, and it means, therefore, that the usual standards of journalism do not apply. I think this shows not only poor journalism ethics, but a callous disregard for the victims' families. Now, there was a competitive tender process for the Luna Park lease that began after the fire. And in 1980, the government commenced negotiations with the Grundy organisation, but an agreement could not be reached, so another tender process was initiated. An interdepartmental committee made up of senior public servants recommended the lease go to Australasian Amusements, which was later renamed Harbourside. Several inquiries in later years, including by the New South Wales Corporate Affairs Commission, found no actual or beneficial relationship between Saffron and Harbourside. And David Bafsky, the chairman of Harbourside, successfully sued Fairfax newspapers for alleging that Harbourside was a Saffron front company. But guess who initiated the Corporate Affairs Commission? The answer, Neville Wran. He also supported a subsequent National Crime Authority investigation into Saffron. So if Wran had secretly orchestrated for his drinking pal, Saffron, to get the lease, why would he set up these and support these inquiries? I think the upshot is that none of these specific allegations about Wran regarding the fire cover-up, socialising with Saffron, or corruptly influencing the tender process are substantiated by documentary evidence or corroborated with multiple interviews. So my criticisms of Expose the Ghost Train Fire have been backed up by interviews with former premiers Bob Carr and Barry Unsworth, and former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who was a later business partner of Neville Rands, who said the corruption claims against him were just absurd. And there are many others I've interviewed and spoken to as well. David Hill, a former ABC chairman and managing director, told me the program had breached editorial policies and should not have been broadcast. Now, Hill, of course, had worked for Neville Rand and also the Rand government, but he nevertheless thought it was sloppy journalism and was actually very sad that this had happened to the ABC, which he dedicated a large part of his professional life to. Andrew Andersons, a former government architect who was on the tender selection committee for Luna Park, told me that he was misrepresented by the ABC in the documentary. He told the documentary makers that Ram was not corrupt and he saw no evidence of improper influence in the tender process, but they did not include this in the documentary. And I know others who have been feel that they've been duped by the ABC, but they've declined to go public with their criticisms. Now, the ABC response to these criticisms from high-profile individuals has been, I think, hysterical and often very unprofessional. Now, I carry no brief for Neville Rand. I knew Rand, I interviewed him, I edited a book of essays on his government in 2006, and I regard him as a successful political leader. But I also wrote in my edited book, The Rand Era, that his government was slow to act, reactive, and did not go far enough to weed out corruption in the prisons, police, and lower courts. So in May this year, after a number of reports, I said the ABC was simply unaccountable. I felt that it had often treated its audience like with contempt and had become a renegade broadcaster. Now, these are strong criticisms, but this was partly based on the response I had received to the reporting I've done about the documentary. And so I urged the chair and the board to take action and look into this documentary. And I'm now pleased that the board has actually ordered an independent review of the documentary to be undertaken by Chris Masters, a former journalist, or still a journalist, and also academic Rod Tiffin. Now, the board would not order a review of this program if they were entirely happy with the program. There's only been one other similar review ordered by the ABC in the past 9 months. But the ABC, true to form in this case, claimed that the establishment of the review did not reflect adversely on the documentary and said it stands by its journalism. So I think this is an example of the staff challenging the board and have essentially preempted the outcome of the review. I don't think it's arguable that the documentary has serious flaws, and I want to outline a couple of things in conclusion that I think the review should consider. First is the research process, whereby reporters have misunderstood key documents and ignored others and claimed that Rand was heard on the Age tapes in connection with Luna Park, yet produced no tapes or transcripts to verify this. Second, the unethical use of the so-called true crime genre to defend making unsubstantiated allegations that did not have to be proven facts, according to ABC management. Third, adherence to editorial policies, especially those that go to accuracy and fair and honest dealing, and why Rand's former ministerial colleagues, staff, friends, and family were not interviewed for the documentary. Fourth, why interviews with Andrew Andersons and Tony Jacob were selectively edited to support a predetermined view, and aspects of their testimony that countered this narrative was not included in the broadcast. Fifth, the editorial processes that allowed such a flawed program to be broadcast, which the ABC claimed was subject to rigorous oversight by producers, legal counsel, editorial advisors, and also its head of investigations. And finally, I think the ABC needs to answer questions about the broader ethics of journalism, whereby just because Neville Rand is dead, he can be defamed and have his reputation besmirched, perhaps irretrievably so. So let me conclude by saying that I'm a regular ABC viewer and listener, and I admire many of their programs and their journalists. But I was outraged to see so many claims about the fire, who was responsible, about the park lease, and about Rand being made without conclusive or corroborated evidence. I think the documentary dwelled on the grief of families and it put them through unnecessary trauma with wild conspiracy claims. I feel very sorry for them. And I think for them, watching this documentary has been tragedy upon tragedy. Expose the ghost train fire, I don't think, is quality investigative journalism. I think the ABC have treated their audience very poorly, and I think they must be held accountable, and therefore the review cannot afford to be a whitewash. Thank you.
Many thanks, Troy. And so we come to Milton. As I think I said just before we went on the call, that Milton has an article on the matter in the recent issue of the Southern Highlands newsletter. Milton.
Yes, Gerard, I just want to enumerate a number of issues that I believe the ABC deliberately ignored or skated over in the program. Some of those have been touched on by Troy, so I won't elaborate, I won't go into great detail on those. But first of all, I want to make it very clear that all decisions concerning the tender process for the new lease for Luna Park after the fire were made by Cabinet or by a Cabinet committee. They were not made by RAN personally. Second, as Troy mentioned, the recommendation to award the lease to Harbourside Amusement Park, the company which Saffron allegedly controlled, was not made by RAN or by Cabinet. As Troy said, the decision was made by a special committee which comprised six very senior public servants. Third, as Troy mentioned, the only surviving member of that committee, who went on to become the respected former government New South Wales architect, New South Wales government architect, Andrew Andersons, told Troy, and I quote, "The tender process was totally above board. Nobody influenced the panel process. Certainly, I was not told by anybody to do anything. The public servants on the panel were all very experienced and professional," end quote. Fourth, the ABC claimed Saffron wanted the site for commercial development purposes, but the 30-year lease was for the operation of an amusement park, and commercial development on the site would have been a breach of the lease. Even if a government had been sufficiently brave to permit the site to be converted to commercial, and subsequent events have shown that no government has been brave enough to do so, new tenders would have been called. Fifth, as Troy mentioned, the lease did not end up with Saffron. In 1986-87, an inquiry was conducted into Harbourside by the then New South Wales Corporate Affairs Commission. And as Troy said, this was an inquiry that was an initiative of Neville Ram following allegations made in the New South Wales Parliament. The ABC did not tell its viewers that Ram had authorised an inquiry into the very same company which the ABC accused him of favouring. That Corporate Affairs Commission, by the way, was conducted over 17 months and investigated not just Harbourside, but several other companies involved in the ownership structure. 23 witnesses, including Saffron, were examined on oath, and another 11 witnesses were interviewed. A National Crime Authority official was also included in the investigation team, and that commission concluded at the end of the inquiry, and I quote, "There is no evidence that suggests that Abraham Gilbert Saffron has any actual or beneficial ownership in Harbourside." Sixth, the report of the infamous allegation number 27, which Troy has referred to, relies solely on the word of former police sergeant Paul Egg, and as Troy said, one of the police involved in the illegal wiretaps on the phone of Solicitor Morgan Ryan. No other police officer involved in the wiretaps substantiated Egg's claims about Ran. None said they heard Ran's name mentioned in the conversations. The ABC accepted his claims, despite him not hearing any telephone conversations, despite him not being able to produce tapes, transcripts or summaries, and despite none of the other police officers backing up his claims about Ran. Seventh, as Troy mentioned, completely without corroboration, The program broadcast an absurd allegation by a Saffron intimate that Ran used to have Friday happy hour drinks at Saffron's home in the company of many other people. And I stress that. She said it was in the company of many other people. In a city which floats on unsubstantiated rumours and malicious gossip, does the ABC seriously believe that these social occasions involving many people would have remained a secret for more than 40 years? And finally, and I could go on for much longer, as Troy said, the ABC claimed with no evidence at all that the cover-up of this crime involved Neville Rann. The presenter's exact words were, and I quote, essentially, the allegation is that the reason why it, that is the investigation, didn't go any further was because of corruption further up. There are a lot of powerful people in powerful places protecting Abe. So it went right to the top, we are told. In the context of the program, the use of the phrase went right to the top can only mean that the ABC was now accusing Rann of also being involved in covering up a mass murder. Not a single person interviewed on the program made such an accusation, nor was any other evidence, documentary or otherwise, produced to justify this claim. The statement was simply made up by the presenter and allowed to go to air by those supposedly supervising the program. I lodged a complaint about the program under the ABC's so-called independent complaints handling procedures, which, as Gerard knows, is administered by the Audience and Consumer Affairs, which is a division of the ABC. My complaint was predictably dismissed. The reasoning used by ACA in rejecting my complaint has significant implications for the ABC board. The ABC board, in the wording on the ABC website, is, and I quote, responsible for ensuring that the gathering and presentation of news and information is accurate and impartial according to recognised standards of journalism. One way the board does this is through the editorial policies it has adopted and which it requires ABC management to implement. In my complaint, I pointed out there was no corroboration for any of the allegations made about Rann and that these uncorroborated allegations were clearly in breach of the editorial policies, specifically 2.1, which deals with accuracy, and 5.3, which deals with fair and honest dealing. For an ABC journalist to make reasonable efforts to ensure that material facts are accurate, which is one of the requirements, requires corroboration by at least one independent and trustworthy source. This obligation for multiple sources is also one of the recognised standards of journalism. That obligation does not cease because a person is dead and therefore unable to sue. The obligation becomes even more important when a person is unable to defend himself or herself. This is recognised in the ABC's editorial guidance notes relating to accuracy, which notes, and I quote, one of the central challenges for any journalist or content maker is how far they need to go to cross-reference and confirm through multiple sources. In rejecting my complaint, ACA did not deny that there had been no corroboration for the allegations about Rann, but said that the program had presented these as, and I quote, allegation rather than fact, end quote. It said that therefore it was satisfied no breach of the standard occurred. This is a disturbing interpretation by ABC management of the editorial policy relating to accuracy. The ACA is saying that the obligation for multiple sources does not apply if an allegation is presented as an allegation without any factual basis. If we just pause for a moment, does anyone seriously believe that the ABC's lawyers would permit an uncorroborated allegation to go to air that, say, Bob Carr or Maurice Yemmer, the site two Labor premiers still alive, used to have Friday night drinks with a prominent Sydney gangster? Of course not. So what ACA are really telling me is that since Neville Wran is dead, the obligation for multiple sources for this allegation about Wran and Saffron does not apply. This ABC management reinterpretation of the board's editorial policies is not an isolated one. The ABC editorial director, Craig McMurtry, was asked at the Senate Estimates Committee why only one source was used in the program for the allegation about Wran and Saffron. He replied, quote, "The matter concerning Mr. Wran was not a focus of the documentary series. Normally in these sorts of situations, where they're going to be a particular allegation or line of inquiry, that would certainly require them to speak to other sources," end quote. As noted earlier, three serious allegations were made about Wran in the program. So to suggest that Wran was not a focus of the investigation is absurd. What McMurtry is saying is that as far as ABC management is concerned, the requirement for multiple sources does not apply if a person is simply collateral damage in a documentary or report. Once again, let's just pause there. If we swap Bob Carr's name for Neville Wran in this program, is McMurtry seriously suggesting that the ABC's legal department would say to him, "No worries, Craig, Carr is not a focus of the program, so we don't need any corroboration for the claim made about him"? Of course not. The money paid out to Bob Carr would significantly dwarf the $100,000 plus, which the ABC has just forked out for Louise Milligan's injudicious tweet. If I was a member of the ABC board and reading the ABC editorial director's comment, I would be asking the managing director, where does it say that in our editorial policies? These are the issues the board now faces. The directors must ask themselves the following questions. Is ABC management correct in interpreting the ABC editorial policies as inapplicable when an allegation about a person is presented as an allegation without a factual basis? Is the editorial director correct in saying that there's no obligation for multiple sources if a person about whom an allegation is conveyed is not a focus of the program? And thirdly, do the ABC's editorial policies not apply if a person is dead? Now, I won't, Troy has already mentioned the fact that this the board has now commissioned a review, and I must say the ABC chair, Ida Buttrose, to her credit, has recognised that these issues have arisen for the program. I understand that review is now complete, but that the findings of the reviewers will not be made public until their report has been considered by the board, and only if the board decides to make it public. That will be a very interesting test for the ABC's membership of the Right to Know Coalition. In my opinion, if the ABC board stands by this program, it will have no option but to amend its editorial policies to require a journalist or a presenter in making an uncorroborated allegation about a person to have to also say words to the effect, "The ABC does not suggest that this is other than an unproven allegation and the facts have not been checked." Just finally, Jared, I want to note one of the many odd things about this program is why the media critics have ignored it, except for you. This program was obviously a very expensive one to make, even though we only learned recently the total cost was nearly $2 million. It made explosive allegations, which were basically ignored by the rest of the mainstream media. It obviously challenged the ABC's editorial policies, and it has progressively attracted considerable criticism, including before the Senate Estimates Committee. These factors should have made it a prime candidate for examination by those who have taken it upon themselves to critique our media. But 4 months after the last episode went to air, it has been totally ignored by the likes of Paul Barry on ABC Media Watch, Chris Warren in Crikey, Meg Simon in Inside Story, and Dennis Muller in The Conversation. I've excluded Chris Mitchell in The Australian from this criticism, since Troy has done the job for him. But this, the fact that the media critics have been so silent on this, I find extraordinarily odd. surely the ABC is not a protected species. I've taken up this reluctance with one of those I mentioned and asked why it was that only the Australian and Gerard Henderson had queried the program's conclusions. This person responded that it was not surprising that these had joined the fray, since criticism of the ABC was part of the culture wars. My response was, if you really believe that, then surely that is even more reason why those who style themselves as independent media critics should have stepped up to the plate. None of them have. I'll leave it there, Gerard, and be very happy to join in on questions.
Thanks, Milton, and thanks, Troy. So we come to questions. We've got to be brief, folks, with our comments or questions, a bit like this. So this, what you have here with in reference to Saffron's associate, Rosemary, is someone believing really what they want to believe. This seems to be increasingly common in section of journalism, that if someone says you something, tells you something that you want to believe, you do believe it. Is this a modern phenomenon, or was this around, Milton, when you were the editor of a major Australian newspaper?
No. The requirement for multiple sources, Gerard, has been something that has been drummed into journalists from the moment they walk through the door of whether it's a newspaper office or television office or a radio studio. If somebody had come to John Lyons when he was editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and said, I've got a witness who says that Neville Wran and Abe Saffron used to have drinks on a Friday night, sort of happy hour drinks with a group of other people, John's first response would have been, well, what corroboration do we have for that? And when the journalist said, oh, I don't have any corroboration, I've just got this person, he would have laughed that person out of the office. So why John, as an executive producer of the of this program, would have allowed that uncorroborated allegation to go to air, I found just astounding. And I have no explanation for it. It is one of many, many puzzling things about this program.
Thanks, Robin. So we move on. Lindsay Ellison. Lindsay.
All right, can I be heard?
Yes.
Right. I want to ask the speakers about the current, or their attitude to the current law of defamation. Mr. Coburn spoke about the fact that the law is you can't defame the dead. And most journalists and authors and newspaper editors support a liberalisation of the law of defamation. And one of the things about the internet and podcasts is when you watch American television every day, people get defamed, as we would know, left, right and centre. Accepting that there should be more rigour generally in reporting, you referred to the Age tapes, which was the National Times, maybe going adventurous, but there was a lot of truth in what the Age tapes said. What is your current attitude to the laws of defamation, and would society be better or worse off if we had the American standards, or lack of them, compared to our British common law standards?
Who wants to lead on that? Bruce?
I'm happy to lead first, Gerard.
Okay, that's fine. Okay.
Simply because in a recent speech, I actually argued that the current law that you can't bring an action for defamation on behalf of a person who is dead, I believe, I've now come to believe, this law should be amended. We've just had a change in the defamation law in New South Wales to make life much more difficult for plaintiffs. Juries in New South Wales can now decide the defendant in a defamation action had acted reasonably in the circumstances, or reasonably believed that publication is in the public interest. Now, I believe that's a very significant reform, and one which media companies have been arguing for some time. But I've actually believed that there should be a quid pro quo for that reform. And my belief now is that I think a child or a spouse of a dead person should be able to bring an action for defamation on behalf of a dead loved one if their reputation has been trashed. I've argued I don't believe the damages should attach to any action, but there should be a requirement, if the action is successful, a requirement for correction and apology on the part of those who made that defamation. That's not a very popular, I must confess, that's not a very popular position to put. And even lawyers, many lawyers don't agree with me. But I don't think that it would be open to significant abuse, because the spouse or the children would have to weigh up their meager inheritance, the sizes of their mortgage, the size of their bank account, compared to the very deep pockets of most of the organisations we're talking about. But nevertheless, I do believe that the law should be amended, because I now believe that the current privilege that journalists have of not of being able to defame the dead, I think it is being roundly abused.
Troy, do you want to comment on that?
Oh, look, I would just say that I generally agree with Milton on that. I mean, a lot of media organisations and journalists are very critical of our defamation laws, because there seems to be a low bar to jump to claim that you've been defamed. But I just think at the end of the day, if a journalist is going to criticise somebody, it's got to be based in fact and it's got to be defendable. That doesn't mean you can't have a robust opinion, and that some people, you know, might have to just accept that their feelings can be hurt by commentary. And I'm in the political commentary business as well as the journalism business. But I think when you're making such grave and serious allegations like this, you really got to back it up with the facts. And I think it's a bit of a cop-out that the ABC can only make these claims about Ran because he's dead.
Dennis O'Day? Dennis, are you there? Bob Corbin? Is anyone home? Dennis O'Day, Bob Corbin?
They might be on mute. They might be on mute, are they, Jared?
They might be on mute, but I don't know how to get a message to them. So I can't do that. So, all right. So let's progress on. Milton, you made the point that I'm not sure whether you or Troy made the point that it's most unusual for the ABC board to set up an independent inquiry, which in a sense goes over the top of the Canberra-based audience and consumer affairs. You said there was one other occasion this year, but I'm not aware of many occasions over the years. This seems a bit unusual.
Yeah, no, I made the point that when I looked at, you can look at these online, Jared. There's only been one other review of this nature in the past 9 months, so they're pretty rare, and I think it does show that the reporting and Milton's complaint and other complaints have really prompted the board to take action. But as I said in my presentation, I find it extraordinary that as soon as that was reported a couple of weeks ago, the ABC issued a statement saying they stand by the documentary. This is not significant. There's nothing to see here. It's incredible, really. I mean, they really should just allow the review to do its work, and that review should be made public. But it is a rare step, and I think it does show a degree of concern within the ABC. I'll just make a quick comment as well, Jared, about something Milton mentioned about my reporting. That, you know, this has come from a usual suspect to being the Australian newspaper. Well, I can say quite truthfully and quite honestly that not a single person at the Australian asked me to write about the Luna Park documentary. Nobody ever. It was simply my own initiative. I mean, I watched the documentary and I decided that this needed to be written about, this needed to be critiqued. And so I did it. And I'm not a usual ABC critic. I don't tend to sort of engage in the culture wars, as they're called. But, you know, this is just part of the sort of smear, I guess, against the ABC have made against me and against Milton and others who have criticised it. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary to see someone like Sally Jackson, who runs the ABC's communications, say to me in emails that she doesn't really care what Bob Carr or Barry Unsworth thinks or Malcolm Turnbull or David Hill. They couldn't care less, and they don't feel they've got any need to respond. And that just shows you, you know, what's happened to the ABC, that they can just treat any valid criticisms with absolute contempt.
I think we're right. Bob Corbett, I think, is back online. Bob, and then we go Frank Conroy and Wendy Bacon. So, Bob?
Yeah, thank you, Gerard. I just have a question. Let me preface it by saying Neville Rann resigned suddenly as Premier and Member of Parliament on the 4th of July 1986 without, as I read it, any explanation. I just wondered if Troy or Milton is aware if that resignation had anything whatever directly or indirectly to do with the Luna Park fire and the subsequent inquiries resulting from that.
Can I leap in that first, Gerard?
Yeah, sure.
Bob, I have to disagree with you when you say that Rann resigned suddenly. Rann had been Premier for 10 years. He'd been leading the Labor Party for 13 years. And by the way, up till then, that had been a record period of tenure for any New South Wales Premier. His resignation was sudden. It was a surprise, but I don't think it's accurate to say that he resigned suddenly. I mean, that's a bit like saying that Bob Menzies resigned suddenly. At some stage, a political career comes to an end. And Rann thought after 10 years at the top, it was time for him to get out and do something else. I can assure you that it certainly had nothing to do with the Luna Park allegations. And basically, by 1986, there were no such allegations. This is something that really has come about very, very recently. You know, I think it started, I mean, even though Troy said there were rumours around 20-odd so years ago, mainly, I think, through the work of Martin Sharp. But it wasn't until the Sydney Morning Herald, I think quite wrongly, they would now agree, reported the word of a Saffron niece who claimed her uncle was behind the fire. I think that was the first time it's appeared in print. And when I say that I think they did it wrongly is that it's been reported that that niece subsequently tried to retract her comments, but that the Sydney Morning Herald apparently has evidence that she did so. So I certainly don't believe that he resigned suddenly, and I certainly don't believe it had anything to do with Luna Park.
Okay, I think we'll go to Frank Conroy.
Thanks, Gerard. I hope you can hear me.
Yep.
Good. You'll see me in a minute. There I am. I just wanted to ask both Troy and Milton, if I may, whether this is not the first time, of course, that Four Corners has been put under question by many people about their investigations. And I've been watching it for their full 60 years, I have to tell you. And I am worried about the future of Four Corners, to be honest. And I just wonder whether you have a comment about, first of all, do you think that the ABC review that's in foot or on foot should consider what's going on in Four Corners generally? And secondly, what do you believe about the future of Four Corners as a program and almost a flagship of the ABC's current affairs?
Well, I would just note briefly that this was actually not a Four Corners program, Frank. This was a one-off kind of documentary as part of this exposed series. But I think there's some valid criticisms to make about a range of Four Corners programs and other programs, and no media organisation, you know, is infallible. But the point I'd make about Carrie Meldrum Hanna, and I've had a number of people contact me while I've been doing this reporting to tell me how unhappy they were with her journalism about a whole range of things over the years. And you can see this in the documentary. I'll make a brief comment about this, Jared, which is that the style of reporting is not something that I do, and I've been a journalist at The Australian for 10 years, and I don't think Milton would do this either, where you kind of lead the person on. So in the case of the Abe Saffron employee, Carrie Meldrum Hannah literally hands her a photograph and asks, you know, whether Neville Ram was ever seen with Abe Saffron. And so she kind of agrees with it. But she didn't volunteer it herself, unprompted. And there's another scene, for example, where Genia McCaffrey, the former mayor of North Sydney, is handed this allegation that Ram, it was heard on the age tapes. And she's just simply asked to read it out, read the allegation made by the sergeant, Paul Egg, that Ram was heard on the tapes. And so she reads it out and says, oh, my God, this is incredible. But, of course, there's no context given. It wasn't a volunteered statement. It's just simply being led on. And so there's a question about the style of journalism here, which I think is quite unethical. And a number of people who have been interviewed for the documentary have said that to me, including Andrew Anderson's, including Tony Jacob, that they felt they were being pressured into answering questions or repeating statements that she made, even though they didn't know whether they were true or not. So I think it just gets back to the way you do journalism and not trying to trap people or catch them. And, you know, it's very worrying. And you can see it in the way this documentary has been put together.
Yes, I won't add much to that, Frank, but certainly Troy's right. This wasn't a Four Corners program. And I believe that this program would not have emerged if it had been under the Four Corners wing. No Four Corners journalist has the luxury of spending 18 months to 2 years working on a program. And I think one of the reasons why this program is so poor is simply because of that it's, and we now know that nearly $2 million of ABC money was spent on it. In Four Corners and any other sort of investigative unit, audits are done on a regular basis. And the journalist is asked, journalists and producers are asked, okay, where do we stand? And at some stage, someone must have said to Meldrum Hanna and Begley, okay, what have you got? You've been working on this for a year. And essentially they would have to say, well, we've got a lot of allegations, but we've got no corroboration. We've got these documents. For example, document allegation number 27. But basically that had been published, widely reported 3 years ago. So at some stage, an executive producer should have said, hey, hold on a moment. We've got nowhere. We've spent $1 million. We can't continue to throw good money after bad. This is, you know, what the foreign policy wonks would call mission creep. And at some stage, the boom should have been lowered. And certainly on a program like Four Corners, the boom would have been well and truly lowered. And they would have said, look, we've got nowhere on this. We're not going to put together simply a bunch of allegations without any factual basis. Move on. So I certainly don't think this would ever have emerged through the Four Corners program.
Just a quick addition to that, Jared. Some of you who have seen the documentary might remember the scenes with Les Dowd, who they say saw bikies at Luna Park and overheard a conversation about a fire. And Meldrum Hannah goes to great lengths to say this is the first time these allegations have been made, the first time they've been heard. Well, in actual fact, if you just do a search through the National Library's Trove database, which has newspaper articles, I found that Les Dowd had made this statement in a statutory declaration in 1985. So there's a lot of sensationalism in this and a lot of claims that just don't stack up about how new this material is or how they've come across it.
So we're getting very close to the end. Now there's Wendy Bacon.
Yes. Can you hear me? I'm sorry you yes. can't see me. Can. Yeah. Look, I wasn't involved with this program, not even on top of everything that was in it, but I would just like to mention before I ask Milton some questions that Sue Spencer is, I understand, the executive producer or producer of the program. Look, she's a really, really highly respected, as I'm sure many of you know, executive producer in the past of Four Corners. She's probably one of the most respected journalists in Australia. So I thought I should mention that just in passing. Look, Milton, I did not cover the Luna Park fire, and I'm not on top of everything that was published at that time, but in sort of rifling back through some old papers, I did come across Evan Whitten's articles at the time, which certainly, and I assume you've read them too or reread them, and he really was at the time putting a series of things that I'm happy to send this to you, which really questioned the claim that RAN wasn't involved in the decision. Now, you've obviously got access to some other material, and I'm wondering, is it possible to get from you, material about the investigation into Harbourside Amusements? Because my impression was that it was quite well known back in those years that Saffron was operating through fronts, and there was names there that were recognised as being Saffron-associated names. So I was really surprised in what you said about that. And so I'm just wondering, can this material that you've referred to, can that be made available to others? Because I would like to go back and assess it now. So yeah, that's really what I want to ask you. How accessible is your own material that you're relying on, and have you reread Evan's article? Because Evan again was a very respected journalist, and there was certainly material at the time that was being published that suggested there was a lot more to the Luna Park fire, and certainly Saffron's potential involvement, because okay. Saffron in those years was involved in a number of fires.
Okay, Milton, you've been
you're
paying yourself against not one but two respected journalists.
Very quickly, Wendy, the two key documents that I've referred to, one is the report of allegation number 27. That's available online. Yeah, so if you Google, and you'll see that in that report, they go into considerable detail about how the lease was allocated, the tender processes that were involved, who was actually involved on the committee. So that's a public document, as I said. It was made public in 2017 and is available online. The report of the Corporate Affairs Commission, I must confess, I had to spend a half a day in the State Library, but I read that from cover to cover. Included in that is references to how the report came about, the fact that it quotes letters from RAN as Premier to his then Attorney General, Terry Sheehan, requesting that the inquiry be undertaken. It cites two actual letters. The first is basically requesting Terry to commission the inquiry. I think in those days, it was run through the Corporate Affairs Commission, the various state Corporate Affairs Commissions operated through a national body collection of attorneys general. These, of course, all blossomed ultimately into ASIC. And then there was a second letter from RAN in which he asked him to make whatever investigation, the results of the investigation, available to the National Crime Authority. Unfortunately, I don't know of any other copy of that, Wendy, other than...
I'll go to the State Library.
Yeah.
I'll go to the State Library.
I would be very interested in any material you had about on Evan, because, you have a high regard for Evan Whitten.
Milton.
Yes, I don't recall.
Milton, just the last couple of words you said we missed. You said we'd be interested in any material on Evan, and then we didn't hear the rest. Go on.
I'm sorry. Yes, I would be interested in any of the documents, the reporting that Wendy was referring to by Evan. I have come across quite a few reports by Evan, but I certainly don't recall one of them in relation to the Luna Park fire.
And my other question was actually one about Askin.
Now, Wendy, I don't want to cut you off. We've got to be brief because we're due to finish. Yeah, okay, question about
Okay. Just on the question of the DEB being able to not being able to sue, you remember when Askin died, it was pretty the first time that the serious allegations about corruption were published in relation to him. And that had had a whole lot of problems with reporting it before. What do you think about that now in retrospect?
Okay, just before you answer, wait, hang on just a second. We're talking about the former Liberal Premier of New South Wales, Bob Askin, because it's a long time ago. Yeah, so, Milton.
Yes, I think I've believed for some time now, Wendy, that the allegation, the two significant allegations about Askin, and that was the fact that he was receiving $100,000 a year from the illegal casino operators, and the other that he received a sort of a going away present from SB Bookmakers. I put them in the not proven category. I'm not saying that they're right, and I'm not. I don't believe they're wrong. I have discussed this on regular occasions with David Hickey, who, as you know, Wendy, was the journalist who broke the story, originally broke the story. I must say, David has multiple sources for those allegations, which I haven't seen. But he's quite willing to show those sources to everyone. So I'm certainly not discrediting. But I think it's one of those situations where if the National Times had been sued, say by Molly Askin, then it would have been an opportunity for David, if it had gone to court, to put forward the sources that he actually had relied on.
Yeah. I've got to wind it up there. Just a final comment from both of you in relation to the Four Corners program. What happens if there's a report to the board? There is a report to the board doesn't release it, which has happened in the past, I think. What do you do then?
I think it's quite likely that if the board decided not to release it, that the Senate Estimates Committee, Jared, which I think is meeting again in October, would make a formal request of the board for the report. I believe that has happened on one other occasion where a parliamentary committee had basically said to the board, after the board had said a particular report was not going to be released, demanded the release of the report, and it was subsequently made available. But I would be very surprised.
In relation to the report on the Drummond insiders that came out after the last election, I think that's right. The case.
Okay. I would be very surprised, however, if the board did not make this report public.
Troy?
Yeah, I just would echo what Milton said there. I think there's huge public interest in seeing this review. I should also note briefly that obviously the New South Wales Police and the coroner is re-looking at this, and they've repeatedly asked the ABC to provide material, including, and the police minister has asked as well, for the unedited versions of the interviews to be handed over. And the last time I checked, even though the request had been made many months ago, the ABC has not done that. So that should be another alarm bell for people concerned about the approach to the interviews used in this documentary.
Well, just very quickly, thanks to both Milton and Troy for a great discussion tonight and for the careful preparation of their papers, and for all of you who joined in on the call, which made it a very lively discussion period. It was great to have sponsored it here, and Anne and I are very happy that we all had a great night. So many thanks to everyone involved, and see you next time. Bye.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jared.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.